Hi, this is Don Weaver welcoming you to Valley Writers Read. Tonight, a special treat, as the host of our program, Franz Weinschenk, reads a story of his called A Hike Down Colony Mill Road. This is a true story of what took place about 120 years ago up in the Sierra east of Visalia in what is now Sequoia National Park. It involves a group of utopian socialists called the Kaweah Colony. Here to read it for you is Franz Weinschenk.
Little birdie, what makes you fly so high? It's because I am a true little bird, and I do not fear to die. Little birdie, what makes your wings so blue? It's because I've been a-grieving, grieving after you.
A Hike Down Colony Mill Road. On the Saturday of the hike, we got up nice and early, drove down to Visalia, then east toward the foothills, through Lemon Cove and Three Rivers, and for a short distance into Sequoia National Park to the Ash Mountain Park headquarters. That's where our ranger guide signed about 10 of us in and promptly loaded us into a van and a sedan. It took about a half an hour to drive up to the 5,500-foot level, not all that far from Crystal Cave, a popular tourist attraction. It's mid-May, and on the way up, besides the gorgeous scenery in general, we got to see quite a few large, showy, cactus-like yucca plants now in bloom with balloon-sized clusters of small white lantern-like flowers glistening in the morning sun. Full of vim and vigor, we hopped out at the trailhead, loaded our rucksacks, spilling over with lunches, snacks, and water, and started out on what we were told would be about an 8-hour trek down the 10-mile-long Old Colony Mill Road. It all started with a mild uphill for a mile or so until we arrived at the actual site where just about 125 years ago, a group of utopian socialists calling themselves the Kaweah Colony built their lumber mill. There's no trace of it anymore, mainly because, as we learned later, the thing burned down years ago and the lush pine forest has regenerated itself to the point where you can't tell that there were ever any buildings there at all. Nearby, however, is a slowly deteriorating cabin which used to be a ranger station. When Sequoia Park first opened its doors in the early part of the last century, for some 34 years, this ranger station served as the residence of the ranger charged with overseeing the Cedar Springs checkpoint on the only road in and out of the park at that time. What we'll be walking down is essentially that same road, the road the colonists built, reduced now to a trail, which drops some 4,000 feet back down to the valley floor. The old ranger cabin has just been left there for the elements to decompose. Our group explores it inside and out, being careful not to step on rotten boards or lean up against wobbly walls. From its very inception, the road the colonists built was designed to haul lumber from their mill down to the valley. By modern standards, it's quite narrow, and even later when the Park Service converted it into a road for motor vehicles, it could still only accommodate one-way traffic, no passing, so that during all those 34 years that the road served the park, motorists were only permitted to enter the park in the mornings and exit in the afternoons. After a short break at the ranger station, we get started once again on the long descent down, the trail never all that steep, just a steady drop in altitude, more or less following the downward slope of the North Fork of the Kaweah River. Occasionally, we stopped to look at the scenery, at some interesting vegetation or a trace of animal life. A biologist in the group discovers the decaying body of a young deer just off the trail. After a thorough examination, he says, "Looks like a mountain lion got him." Man, that quiets us down. We look around cautiously. It's probably not a place where you'd want to hang around too long. Better move on. And we do so expeditiously.
As I went out one morning to breathe the pleasant air, lolly-toodum, toodum, lolly-toodum day. As I went out one morning to breathe the pleasant air, I overheard a mother just scolding her daughter fair, lolly-toodum, toodum, lolly-toodum day.
The story of the Kaweah colony, that's what they call themselves, starts about 135 years ago in 1875. America was a lot different then. No cars, planes, computers, cell phones, radios, televisions. All the time our country was going through an era of extraordinary industrialism when super businessmen and bankers dominated their respective industries and managed to amass huge personal fortunes. And although many of these multimillionaires, often toward the ends of their lives, contributed to philanthropic projects like the construction of libraries and museums, history records that the closing decades of the 1800s were pretty much dominated by a few extremely wealthy people like Carnegie, Rockefeller, Vanderbilt, J.P. Morgan, and Leland Stanford. At the time, many called them robber barons, tycoons who pursued anti-competitive and unfair business practices in their attempts to dominate and control whole industries like the railroads, banks, and the production and distribution of steel. It's often been described as a period manipulated by a few of the extremely wealthy who were able to control many of the impoverished masses. It wouldn't be until 1900, under the administration of Teddy Roosevelt, who some historians have nicknamed the Trust Buster, that many issues like child labor, abusive working conditions, the 40-hour week, and what he liked to call a living wage were addressed. Indeed, there are numerous records of sweatshops and difficult working environments reported from all over the country. But certainly one of the worst was the life of the average seaman at the time. Since the majority of ships in those days used sails, they required many hands to do all that had to be done on each vessel. Overall working conditions in the maritime industry were particularly appalling. Sailors were subject to corporal punishment, fed vile rations, slept in cramped quarters, and could be arrested for desertion if they left their ships. In addition, ship owners frequently used the practice of shanghaiing or forcibly conscripting likely crew members to serve one or more terms working aboard ship, usually after having been rendered senseless by alcohol, drugs, or a sharp blow to the head. San Francisco, being a prominent seaport, in many ways was one of the worst ports for the practice of shanghaiing sailors. And that's really where the Kaweah colony started, with the efforts of a San Franciscan socialist dreamer by the name of Burnet Haskell to improve the sailors' conditions. He formed the Coast Seamen's Union, which later merged with the Sailors' Union of the Pacific. His contemporaries tell us that he was a brilliant man who dominated most conversations with a flood of words, chain-smoking all the while. A fine writer and brilliant speaker, he turned out to be one of the most erratic and bizarre figures in labor history. Haskell briefly attended three universities, Oberlin, Illinois, and UC Berkeley, but never graduated. After working in a law office for a time, he studied law on his own and passed the California State Bar in 1879. He tried lawyering for a while, but found it rather boring. Very interested in politics, he worked for the Republican County Convention, was appointed tax collector, even served in the California National Guard, But since he was so puzzled and confounded by the extremes of excessive wealth on the one hand and devastating poverty on the other, brought on by the Industrial Revolution, he started thinking in terms of radical socialism. He became an enthusiastic reader of Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. Interviewed before he died, he actually confessed to putting together some bombs, though all the historians who have studied his life and the Kaweah colony, which during its existence would essentially be under his leadership, agree that there was never a trace of a single act of violence resulting from Haskell's speeches, writings, or activities. At bottom, Haskell wanted to prove that some kind of a system of cooperative socialism might work. That's really at the heart of what the Kaweah colony was all about. It was to be a society based on social cooperation, contrary to one which values competition and individualism. Since Haskell, of course, believed in the former, he gathered a small group of like-minded individuals, many of them former sailors, to see if they could organize a cooperative colony somewhere. They were profoundly influenced by a book called Cooperative Commonwealth by a Danish-born immigrant by the name of Lawrence Grönlund. It was in this book that they discovered many of the operational principles which were later used to manage the Kaweah colony. Haskell envisioned an ideal society in which working members would own and control the production, development, and distribution of whatever resources they had, where you got paid according to how much you worked, and where all people, including women, were considered equal. Two of his most important confederates from the very beginning to even beyond the bitter end were James Martin, who was born in England, and John Redstone, who came to California as a 49er. We'll be hearing more about Martin. As for Redstone, he is considered the least radical of the Kaweah group leaders and the one who in later years became the most looked upon elder statesman of the colony. In 1884, Haskell and his confederates organized a land purchasing company, each member on a mission to find a place where they could spawn their socialist utopia. One member of the group was C. F. Keller, who hailed from the little town of Traver and who really by coincidence overheard what he thought would be a great buy for them. He was traveling on a train through the San Joaquin Valley and by a twist of fate just happened to be sitting behind two civil engineers, one of whom was telling his companions about the magnificent forest in the Sierra east of Visalia, which had just been put up for sale on the open market by the federal government. Keller would later describe overhearing this conversation as a revelation from God himself. Haskell and some of his people went down to check on Keller's report and were very much impressed. And that's when they began thinking seriously about claiming the land near the Kaweah River in what is now Sequoia National Park, just about right where we were walking down that trail. Their idea was to harvest and sell the abundant timber in the area and use the profits to support their dream colony. They would live by the principles stated in Grönlund's book in a system they described as Christian socialism. So, beginning on Monday, October 5th of 1885, 53 of the future colonists dribbled into the federal land office in Visalia and filed applications to purchase adjoining timberlands near the Kaweah River. Each claim was for a quarter of a section, or 160 acres. It cost $10 to file. They filed for adjoining claims so that the combined acreage of the colony turned out to be 8,480 acres. The then publisher of the Visalia Delta newspaper, Colonel George Stewart, heard about what was going on. To him, somehow these men looked suspicious. For one thing, many of them had foreign-sounding names, and what really piqued his misgivings was that they all put down the same San Francisco street address. He was so alarmed that he warned the land commissioner that he suspected some kind of a fraudulent land scheme to secure timberland monopolies up there in the mountains. Other suspicious Visalians began to believe that the future colonists were dummy filers acting as a front for a scheme of a big company to obtain and exploit valuable timberlands up in the forest.
To everything turn, 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 there is a season. Turn, 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 and a time for every purpose under heaven. A time to build up, a time to break down, a time to dance, a time to mourn, a time to cast away stones, a time to gather stones together. To everything turn, 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 there is a season. Turn, 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 and a time to every purpose under heaven.
By this time, we had probably walked a total of 4 miles or so down out of the pine forest and into oak country. On our left, thousands of feet below, even though the view was obscured by a kind of maze, is what they call Deep Canyon, where we could make out the Marble and the Middle Fork of the Kaweah River. When somebody remarked about the hazy atmosphere, our ranger told us that because of the fairly consistent invasion of smog from the San Joaquin Valley, the ability to see into the distance had become more and more compromised up here in Sequoia, so much so that they no longer thought that fire lookout towers to spot developing fires, as in the old days, were a good idea. But to get back to the colonists, complying with the government regulations, 60 days after they filed their original claim, they returned to Visalia to pay them off. But on orders of the Department of Interior, the land agent told them that he could not accept their money because there was a suspicion of land fraud. The government would embark on an investigation, after which, if no irregularities were uncovered, their claims would certainly be honored. Thus began a 5-year bitter inquiry, which, for all practical purposes, ended up with the colonists being denied their claims, but at the same time with the founding of Sequoia National Park. At first, the colonists were probably overly optimistic and naive because they didn't focus on anything but the successful establishment of their dream community. They were so sure that their claims were legitimate, so certain that their purchases would be approved and honored, that they enthusiastically went ahead with their plans, almost forgetting about the government's investigation altogether. To begin with, many of them took up homestead residences along the Kaweah River. For a time, they thought about building a railroad to haul timber down from the mountains. But since they clearly didn't have the resources to do that, they chose instead to build a wagon road up to about the 5,000-foot level through what would prove to be very rugged terrain indeed. Construction of the road actually began in 1886, with a crew on average of about 20 men, most of them ex-sailors, who used mainly hand tools, picks, shovels, axes, wheelbarrows, crowbars, a mule to haul water up from the river, and a small supply of dynamite. One time, as we were walking down the trail, we noticed a fairly long outcropping of bluish rock through which the colonists had blasted their road. They called it the elephant, a term inherited from the 49ers, meaning a strange, unusual sight, a location which signified great hardship. Whenever the road had to traverse gullies or ravines, in order to keep the fill rock and gravel from sliding down into the abysses below, they had to first drill holes in the underlying granite and cement steel pins into the solid rock below. These pins acted as anchors to hold up the rocks, gravel, and sand and soil they used to top off the roadbed. C.F. Keller, the same man who originally overheard the conversation about the timberland in Sequoia, was promoted to be the first foreman. However, after about a year, he became the source of serious dissatisfaction because, in the crew's estimation, the road wasn't gaining enough altitude to ever make it up into the high country. So, since this was a cooperative society, the workers simply organized a general assembly, passed the resolution, and Keller was voted out in favor of a new foreman by the name of Horace Taylor. From the day Taylor took over, the road started rising, never too precipitously, but always on a steady and uncompromising upward angle. Indeed, as you come down the road, you can almost tell where Taylor's road ends and Keller's begins, because in the case of the latter, the trail just sort of lazily arches its way around the long hillsides following the curves in the North Fork of the Kaweah down below. This 10-mile road took 4 years to complete. It cost the colonists $50,000 in cash and $150,000 in labor, although a good deal of the labor costs were never paid. A couple of years into the project, in 1887, the colony experienced a serious split between two of its founders, Charles Keller, the original foreman, and Burnet Haskell, the gung-ho socialist. It had to do with the basic organization of the colony. Keller wanted to make it a traditional corporation so they could sell stock and use the money to fund the colony. But Haskell was more interested in founding a utopian showpiece, one that might be emulated all over America as a true cooperative socialist society. Haskell opted for making the colony a limited partnership, that is, restricting who could join and using only initiation fees to finance the building process. The rift ended in a bitter dispute and in an acrimonious showdown, which Haskell won, and which led Keller and 50 of his followers to walk out on the project altogether. Although membership cost $500, a prospective member and his family, if he had one, could live in the colony with a down payment of $100 and work off the remaining $400. No person was allowed more than one membership. All wives had one vote. Everyone, and this is an important distinction, workers and foremen were paid the same minimum wage, 30 cents an hour for an 8-hour day, a 40-hour work week with time and a half for overtime. The colony issued what they called time checks. 10 minutes worth of work was worth 3 cents. 20,000 minutes, or about 2 months' work, was worth $330. The idea, according to Haskell, was for people to maintain harmonious social relationships with liberty, equality, and fraternity. He said, among the members are the old and the young, the rich and the poor, wise and foolish, educated and ignorant, workers and professionals, all united by their common interest in Kaweah. It also needs to be stated that associate members from all over the world sent in small amounts of money with the intent of actively joining when their membership was paid in full. Some labor unions contributed what they could, and there were even donations from ideal admirers. Still, the Kaweah colony was just about always broke. By the summer of 1887, the colony reached a point where they cleared some trees and brush and established a tent community they called Camp Advance. They envisioned that there would be as many as 500 people come to live there, but actually never got much more than 150. There was a mess hall for singles, a store, print shop, corrals, and a bank where the workers could cash their time checks. Unfortunately, the bank was usually out of money. They also organized a progressive school, which at one point had as many as 50 students. But the school had a hard time keeping teachers because, as Haskell wrote, "The teachers find it impossible to enforce discipline because a child who might feel picked on can openly tell the teacher that he'll go home and tell his father to call a meeting and fire the teacher. Students call their teachers by their first names, attend as they please, complain to parents about every insignificant matter, and corporal punishment is considered barbarism." Haskell's remarkable wife, Annie, who for 60 years kept an extraordinary diary, at one point taught in that school. Here's what she wrote. "The children behave abominably. Books are scarce. The school tent is cold. Oh, how glad, glad, glad I was when it was Friday night. Thank heaven, school is to end. I do hope I shan't have to teach over the holidays."
John Henry was a little baby sitting on his papa's knee, and he picks up a hammer and a little piece of steel. Cried, "A hammer's gonna be the death of me, Lord, Lord. A hammer's gonna be the death of me. I said, a hammer's gonna be the death of me, Lord, Lord. A hammer's gonna be the death of me."
It took a little more than 4 years to finish the road, and just about as they finished in 1890, they commenced building their lumber mill, much of it with the help of a very resourceful and inventive colony member by the name of Irwin Barnard. He planned for a way of bringing power in the form of a huge 8-ton Ajax tractor to the mill. This tractor was powered by a steam engine and looked much like a locomotive, with big steel wheels in the back and a boiler with a tall smokestack up front. But getting Ajax up to the worksite turned out to be really difficult. At Three Rivers, when the tractor crossed the first of three bridges over the Kaweah, because of its enormous weight, it crashed through the bridge, tossing Barnard into the river. Luckily, he was only slightly injured, even though he lost his treasured gold watch, the one he kept in his vest pocket. Fortunately, they were able to pull both him and the tractor out of the water. But now he faced the daunting task of getting that tractor over the middle fork of the river, which is considerably wider and deeper. Barnard made the decision to build a ferry, which he thought would be big and strong enough to carry Ajax across. But just about everybody in town thought him crazy for wanting to do so. Some wanted to build a suspension bridge using surplus cables left over from the San Francisco cable car system. In the end, Barnard won the argument and completed his ferry. You can imagine the tension as they loaded Ajax aboard. Then, just as they started to pull the ferry across, Barnard jumped onto Ajax and, sensing victory, tooted the tractor's whistle all the way across the river. Once they got the thing finally 10 miles up their road and to the mill, they took the wheels off, put it on permanent blocks, and used the steam engine to power belt-driven saws. In theory, at least, the women of the colony had equal rights along with the men. But in practice, it was really the men who ran the place. Women did add a great deal to the cultural side of life, providing musical events, poetry readings, and refining domestic skills. On one occasion, a fire broke out at the mill, and since all the men, as usual, were off attending another one of the many, many meetings, the women valiantly fought the blaze for almost the whole day and actually succeeded in saving the mill. Unfortunately, the colonists were relatively inexperienced lumbermen, and the production of timber turned out to be only about a tenth of what they had envisioned.
Wake up, wake up! What makes you sleep so sound? Them Avenue. Officers are coming, gonna tear your still house down.
Now it needs to be remembered that all this time, as these people were building their road, developing the mill, and settling into their community at Camp Advance, there was a very important fact that they tended to ignore, that the land they were occupying, arranging to live on, and planning to harvest trees from was really not ever legally theirs. They never really had the actual deeds to the land they thought they had signed up to buy. They just believed that since they acted in good faith, had done everything according to the rules and the law, that the investigation about their purchases would prove them in the right, and that in the end they would be deeded the land they had signed to buy. And for a time at least, things did look favorable. In 1889, the government dispatched a special land agent by the name of B.F. Allen, and in 1890, another agent by the name of Andrew Caldwell to investigate the colony and the settlers' claims. Both agents submitted favorable reports. Allen complimented the settlers for their industry and honesty. Caldwell wrote, "I cannot help but testify to their diligence and perseverance in overcoming almost insurmountable difficulties in building their road." However, as all this was going on the national scene in Washington, D.C., during the spring and summer of 1890, legislation was being proposed in Congress to make both Yosemite and Sequoia into national parks. Spurred on by articles written by John Muir in Century magazine, first the Yosemite Bill and later the Sequoia Bill were easily ratified. Then on the first day of October, which was actually the very last day of that session of Congress, somebody substituted a second Yosemite Bill for the first. It expanded the size of Yosemite 5 times larger than originally stated, and also enlarged Sequoia from 2 townships to 7. This bill passed both houses of Congress without a hitch. It was that particular enlargement of Sequoia that really shut the door on the colonists, because it stipulated that the land that the colonists thought that they had bought now lay within the boundaries of Sequoia National Park. No doubt about it, it was this final legislation which ultimately dealt a death blow to these settlers' dreams. To make things even worse, land agent Caldwell had a change of heart and began to express very negative opinions about the colony. He reported to his bosses at the Interior Department that the colonists were cutting timber on land they didn't have title to, and so the district's congressman, Representative Vandeveer, instructed him to warn the trespassers to desist, and if they did not, to lay the facts before the U.S. attorney. Well, in the end, the Kauaians wouldn't stop cutting timber, so that in December of 1890, Haskell and 2 other colonists were arrested and hauled to Los Angeles, where they were put on trial for illegally harvesting timber. It took a jury only 15 minutes to find them guilty, and they were each fined $300. As bad as all that was, the next year, 1891, proved to be even worse. Agent Caldwell accused the leaders of the colony of running a bunco game par excellence, making the leaders rich while impoverishing the poor fools who lived there. Even the San Francisco papers came out against them editorially. In April, Secretary of the Interior Nobel rejected 43 of the original 53 claims of the Kauai colonists outright. He put it this way, "The colonists have no vestige of right to the land, and their entries, therefore, are canceled." Although Haskell tried his best to cheer everybody up that the future might hold some sort of a reversal, many started to leave, and Haskell himself resigned as a trustee in July of 1891.
Where have all the flowers gone?
long time passing. Where have all the flowers gone? Long time ago. Where have all the flowers gone? The girls have picked them, everyone. Oh, when will you ever learn? Oh, when will you ever learn?
It was probably around noon or so that we stopped for lunch. We'd made good progress coming down off that mountain and deserved a good half-hour respite. When we started up again, you couldn't help but notice that the terrain had changed significantly as we made our way through several miles of chaparral. Chaparral is a shrub and plant community that's about 6 to 7 feet high, every inch of it seemingly intertwined with densely growing, drought-resistant shrubs. If somebody hadn't carved out a trail for us, there's no way that we could have navigated our way through such a mass of tightly knit branches and foliage. Even animals have a hard time penetrating chaparral, although some do. Chaparral can survive semi-arid climates, even with prolonged periods of hot weather and long droughts. In order to hold on to all the important moisture it needs to maintain itself, the leaves of its plants are thicker, have a heavy waxy coating, and recessed pores. Chaparral has also developed strategies to survive the fast-moving fires generally started by lightning that happen every few decades. Even though the fires burn all the vegetation above the ground to ashes, because of the chaparral's especially adapted root system, it seems to grow back remarkably fast. Some chaparral plants even use fire cues, such as heat, charred wood, and smoke to germinate their seeds. As we proceeded down even further, we encounter a lot of poison oak, much of it right on or very near the trail. It's a pretty little plant with small, delicate, shiny green leaves, but it's also a plant which we were warned to stay clear of. Glad I wore long pants. A few words about Burnett Haskell's rather remarkable wife, Anna Fader Haskell, Annie for short. Like her husband Burnett, Annie subscribed to many of what was then considered pretty radical ideas, like equality of the sexes and women's suffrage. For example, she didn't ride horses side saddle like a proper Victorian lady, but wore pants and got on a horse just like a man. She liked to smoke cigars and wasn't timid about using some colorful language now and then. For 60 years, she religiously wrote one full page in her diary every single day. Here's an entry not long after she and Burnett were married. "I get so mad at Burnett because he just talks socialism from the minute he comes in until he goes out. Well, not all the time, because he was most pleasant and loving last night. I listen and I laugh. He loves himself best." After moving to Tent City of Camp Advance in 1887, where life was so primitive, Annie went through periods of depression. It was tough adjusting for someone who had lived in San Francisco all her life. The colonists faced tremendous difficulties. Her husband was hardly ever home. At one point, she lost many of her possessions because they were inadvertently left out in the rain. Another time she wrote, "I was so disappointed at not hearing from Burnett today. It seems as if everyone has forgotten me. To think that we creatures who have evolved from moisture and warmth like bugs under a stone should develop a capacity to endure such maddening misery as we do." And then again, "I guess I'm like all women, always whining." That spring, both Annie and her baby son, Astaroth, fought severe illness. She wrote, "The baby is sick. I have consulted my medical book until I'm crazy. It distresses me more than I can tell. Poor little darling. He takes medicine like a little man. I think he has more fever. Then she herself came down with a severe case of dysentery. "Some of these days in bed," she writes, "I thought I would never be able to get up again, and I didn't much care." One morning she awoke with a terrible toothache. A family friend came over and tried to cut the tooth out of her gums, but the pain was too severe. Then she wrote, "I let him knock it out with a nail and a hammer, so, thank heaven, this evening I have no toothache."
Now you go wash them dishes and hush your silly tongue, lolly doodum, doodum, lolly doodum day. You go wash them dishes, hush your silly tongue. You know you ought to marry, then that you are too young, lolly doodum, doodum.
For a time, some of the colonists thought they would begin anew by leasing another lumber mill called the Atwell Mill, which its owners had put on the market. It was located about 20 miles from Kaweah on the road to Mineral King, but ultimately this project failed as well because there wasn't enough timber left on the property. The machinery was old and failing, and the road to Mineral King was in extremely poor condition. Toward the end of 1891, things got even worse, if that's possible. Haskell closed down the newspaper. A colony member by the name of Peter Ting, very angry at the colony leadership, denounced them to the Visalia Delta newspaper. "My aim was," he stated, "to expose their fraud and to save families from being ruined by such vile creatures as Haskell and the other trustees. It's nothing more than a confidence game." The fact that the colony was ending brought on only bickering and fighting. And to top that off, the suicide of a young colony member, Frank Wigginton, shocked the whole community. The San Francisco Chronicle blamed it on the colony. Haskell acknowledged that the Kaweah colony had failed. "Those who had believed that they would be burglars of paradise," he wrote, "that they would earn upon this earth the kingdom of heaven, have abandoned their purpose and are routed and disorganized, now babbling in tongues." The next year he returned to San Francisco to take up being a lawyer again. Although Annie joined him for a while, it was clear their marriage was over, and she returned to the valley to become a schoolteacher. He started drinking and passed away in 1907. After his death, Annie wrote, "Burnett is gone. It seems that when I write that, there's nothing more to be said. But I think many thoughts. I feel so downhearted and dreary, and think of the thousand things about Burnett when he was young and full of enthusiasm." After the colony closed, the members scattered. A few stayed in the Three Rivers area, where even to this day some of their descendants reside. A word about James Martin. He had been the trustee with the colony from the very beginning. Originally from England, he always had the airs of a distinguished gentleman, and in his later years, crowned with a beautiful head of snow-white hairs, always exhibited impeccable manners. Even as an old man, while working in an apple orchard, he insisted on wearing a necktie. Martin never gave up trying to get the government to reverse its ruling about the colony, and at a minimum repay the colonists for the use of the road that they had built and for the timber that they, according to him, legally had bought when the colonists first settled there. An inveterate letter writer, some 40 years after all this had happened, he actually appealed to Eleanor Roosevelt. "This is not a call for money," he wrote, "but a request that you will use your womanly influence in securing justice to a number of loyal and worthy American citizens who were and still are the victims of a most unwarrantable outrage at the hands of a former capitalistic administration." Opinions differ about what, if anything, the Kaweah colony accomplished. Without the colony, some assert, Sequoia National Park, with all of its gorgeous scenery and the majesty of some of the oldest and largest trees on earth, would never have been established. Others, like the well-known historian Carrie McWilliams, sees it differently. The Kaweah colony, he writes, forms an important chapter in the neglected history of early cooperative experiments in America. Into that story of the cruel butchering of this genuinely progressive idea, it is possible to read a face of social history, not only of California, but of the nation. And at the end, here is how Annie Haskell herself thought about Kaweah. "No use thinking of that day so long ago when Burnett and I were married. My life emotionally seemed to be like a troubled sea. The waves raged and the salt was bitter. I learned a little. I suffered much and laughed a lot. But if I had it all to relive, I wonder if I shouldn't do exactly the same, even with the knowledge I have now. I wonder."
Down in the valley so low, hang your head over, hear the wind blow, hear the wind blow, love, hear the wind blow, hang your head over.
Friends, that was a true story about a utopian socialist colony the history books call the Kaweah Colony, which occupied about 8,000 acres of land up at about the 5,000-foot level, not all that far from what is now a popular tourist attraction called Crystal Cave, east of Visalia in Sequoia National Park. Some of the descendants of the Kaweah colony still live in and around the town of Three Rivers. The 10-mile road that the colonists constructed about where Three Rivers is located up to where they built their lumber mill is now only a narrow trail kept up by the Forest Service. And while some bemoan what they consider to be a gross injustice that was handed out to the colonists by the federal government, others assume that, well, if it hadn't been for that, perhaps there never would have been a Sequoia National Park with its world-renowned giant redwood trees. So out of what was clearly some injustice comes the unequaled beauty and majesty of one of our most treasured national parks. And so we come to the close of another segment of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just get online at kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, our author reader will be Don Parkey. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.